Good morning. Hi. Happy Easter. Happy Easter, you guys. For those of you who came to this building today to avoid hearing those two words, I apologize. But it's too late. It's Easter. Yeah, that's a cool holiday too, right? I mean, whether that's your tradition or not, what a cool symbol, what a cool idea, right? Don't you think? Don't you guys? You guys know the Easter story, right? Basically, somebody was love and they told the truth, so we killed them, which is true. But they didn't stay dead. That's a pretty good story. I mean, I can't argue with that story. Love tells the truth. We tend to kill the things that tell the truth. That's true. We tend to kill our Christs. That's very true. We tend to kill our Buddhas. That's very true. But love doesn't stay dead. Ooh. I don't know. That's delicious, isn't it? What a nice koan. Okay. I'm going to try to fit that in later. Okay. So this morning I would like to talk to you about the Golden Buddha. The Golden Buddha story is contemporary. It's very recent, at least in terms of Buddhist history. And I personally have Jack Kornfield to thank for bringing this to my attention. Do you guys know Jack Kornfield? There's some folks here I know who know Jack Kornfield. I think that this is from, the Golden Buddha story is from his book, The Wise Heart. Does that sound right? I think I'm right. He's prolific, so he's written a lot, and then I've read a lot, and therefore I forget what. Anyway, it's in there somewhere. I think The Wise Heart. But before I tell you the story, I'm going to read to you what's on the front of the program that you guys have there. The story itself, the Golden Buddha story, is too long to put on the front of the program. So instead, what you have there in front of you, and which I will read for the benefit of those friends of ours who are listening to the podcast recording of this, is a quote from Thomas Merton. I figured it would be appropriate to quote a good Christian monk on Easter, and it fits in perfectly with the Golden Buddha story. Do you guys know Thomas Merton?
Yes.
Thomas Merton. So what you have there in front of you on your program, he's describing, to put this in context, he is describing, it's so hard not to attach a fancy word to these. He's describing an experience he had. I'll call it an awakening experience, but now all of us want that, and we're dissatisfied with this. But he has an experience, right? A human experience. And his words around it are as follows. Then it was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts, the depth of their hearts, where neither sin nor desire nor self-knowledge can reach, the core of their reality, the person that each one is in the eyes of the divine. If only they could see themselves as they really are. If only we could see each other that way all of the time. There would be no more war, no more hatred, no more cruelty, no more greed. I suppose the big problem would be that we would fall down and worship each other. Isn't that nice? What a good problem to have that would be too, right? We were supposed to meet at 9 o'clock, Jeff, but I was an hour late because I had so many people to worship on the way. You'd be like, oh, me too. Stuck and talk about traffic, right? What a beautiful experience. In the Zen tradition, we might call an experience like that an awakening, an opening, an enlightenment experience, a Kensho experience. When you not only realize the fundamental non-separateness of all of this, of all of us, but that you see it as fundamentally good. More than that, even fundamentally luminous, fundamentally, words don't get there. He says divine, that works perfectly well. Right? Wow. So, this is important to me because not only does it tie in with our story, but I want to just take a quick aside and say Thomas Merton is a Catholic monk. I forget if he's... Does anybody remember? Is he Benedictine or... He's Trappist. So, what he is describing here, he's not using... He is not, strictly speaking, using blasphemous words. But what he is teaching definitely is right on the edge of going against doctrine, even dogma, which is that we are born broken and flawed. We call this original sin. You were born with the dark stain, and then it is your job to... Right? Because of his direct experience, not his belief system up here in his noodle, because of his direct apprehension, this experience he's describing, and he had many of these, he apprehended something else. He's not using these words, but what he's describing is fundamental blessing, fundamental Buddha. He's saying at the bottom of everything, right, there's just this, and it's good beyond all possible comparisons. No wonder he was in trouble all the time, right? Because you can feel that he's right on the edge of breaking the rule. So here's what I love about this. He doesn't know it here, but he is describing Buddhist psychology. He is describing the core, sort of step one, of the Buddhist psychological worldview, right? Now, I say Buddhist psychology because I'm a 21st century Westerner. There's no such thing as Buddhist psychology. We've just used that word because we use the word psychology in this culture to describe looking at mind to find suffering and then root it out, right? So it wasn't like 200 years ago they would have been sitting around in Buddhist circles going, well, what is our psychology? Well, they wouldn't have had that word, even though they would have been looking at the mind to find creations of suffering and to transform those things, right? Very, very similar mission. They would have used very different words. Here's one of the crucial differences, and this is what the story I'm going to get to at some point will actually illustrate. In the Buddhist tradition, the universality of suffering is acknowledged as what we call the first noble truth, right? Human experience is conditioned by suffering. There's a bunch of different translations, but you get it, right? You're born as a human, you get this too. It comes with the deal. It's part of our wiring, right? Here's what that doesn't imply. That doesn't imply the same thing as original sin. It actually doesn't, and this is harder for us to see, it also doesn't imply fundamental pathology. That's harder for us to see. Does that make sense, the distinction I just made there? Fundamental pathology would sort of be right back to original sin again. You're born broken. Something's wrong with you, and you've got to spend your whole life fixing it, right? Do you sort of feel the difference there? So the reason this is important is because the Four Noble Truths, when we look at those as Westerners, sometimes we consciously do this, sometimes we're taught this, sometimes we unconsciously do this, but we read the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism, the existence of suffering, the cause of suffering, the possibility of the alleviation or transformation of suffering, and then the path to get there. That's the diagnostic model of medicine. We all know this because it's the air we breathe. You don't even know that you know the diagnostic model, but you do because it's what you naturally do when you encounter a problem in your life. Physiological, problem with your relationship, problem with your car, problem with your cat. There's a problem and it has a name. What caused it? Is there something I can do about it? And then I do it. Right? You got poison ivy? It's caused by rolling around in poison ivy, knucklehead. Prognosis, fine, you're going to live. Quit crying. Here's a cream. You can put it on your leg twice a day for 2 weeks. Diagnosis, cause, prognosis, cure, the existence of suffering, the cause of suffering, the prognosis is positive and infinitely optimistic in Buddhism. Because this is our starting point, we oftentimes get the reputation of being like, oh, you guys are such a drag. Suffering, 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 suffering. Like, nobody wants to hang out with you or invite you to their parties because it's all about suffering. And we're kind of like, yeah, what else would it be about? Is there another problem to solve? But anyway, the prognosis is like the gospel, so to speak, the good news, which is, yeah, you can totally do something about that. It's fantastic, actually. And then, of course, the Eightfold Path is this, the prescription, right? So here's the medical model. What I'm wanting to be clear about today is the First Noble Truth does not imply universal pathology. Pathology meaning disease. The Buddha didn't teach when you're born, you're broken. He taught what Thomas Merton just said, which is underneath all of it, underneath even you, is absolutely everything. And it's more than fundamentally good. It's beyond all of your possible preconceptions about good or bad. We call it original blessing because it's a nice complement to like original sin, as sort of a, to put those two on a spectrum. But we're talking about something unvanquishably good. Brilliant, right? So here's the Golden Buddha story, right? Here's the Golden Buddha story. And this is true, by the way. This isn't like a myth. We've turned it into a lovely metaphor. It's a great model for the self. But the story itself is true, right? Okay, now I'm quoting Cornfield. In a large temple north of Thailand's ancient capital, Sukhothai, there once stood an enormous and ancient clay Buddha. Though it was not the most handsome or refined work of Thai Buddhist art, it had been cared for over a period of 500 years and had become revered for its sheer longevity. That's kind of like it's been around for a really long time. It is therefore important. We'll get back to that. Violent storms, changes of government, and invading armies had all come and gone, but the Buddha endured. At one point, however, the monks who tended the temple noticed that the statue had begun to crack, and it would soon be in need of repair and repainting. After a stretch of particularly hot, dry weather, one of the cracks in the clay became so wide that a curious monk took his flashlight and peered inside. What shone back at him was the flash of brilliant gold. Inside this plain old statue made of mud, the temple residents discovered the largest and most luminous gold image of Buddha ever created. Now uncovered, the golden Buddha draws throngs of devoted pilgrims from all over Thailand. Since this was written, it's now a pilgrimage site from people all over the world come to see the golden Buddha. It's huge. He goes on, the monks believed that this shining work of art had been covered in clay and plaster to protect it during times of conflict and unrest. In much the same way, each of us has encountered threatening situations that has led us to cover our innate nobility. Just as the people of Sukhothai had forgotten about the Golden Buddha, we too have forgotten our essential nature. Much of the time, we operate from the protective layer of clay. The primary aim of Buddhist psychology is to help us see beneath this armoring and bring out our original goodness, which we call Buddha nature. This is the first principle of all Buddhist psychology, to see the inner nobility and beauty of all beings. Pretty cool. Right? Pretty cool. So that's the story. I forget the dates. I want to say they discovered it in like the 40s or the 20s or something. So recently, I mean, in terms of world history, this is recent, this discovery. And right away he jumps on this story as a brilliant metaphor, and what a metaphor it is. What a metaphor. You can just picture it, can't you? This like kind of clay plaster Buddha. Oh, it's pretty cool. Yeah, it's been covered in like gold leaf. You know, they do gold leaf there and, you know, paint. And that looks pretty good. It's not like the best thing in the world, but, you know, it's been around for 500 years. So sweet. Cool. And then to make this discovery, oh my God, it's not that at all. So here's our three layers of self. And because this is Easter, I'm going to give you the option of looking at the metaphor, instead of the Golden Buddha, I will give you the metaphor of the holy Cadbury cream egg. Right? I know this goes more deeply for most of you than the story of the Golden Buddha. Now we're really getting serious, right? On the outside of the Cadbury cream egg, we have the foil, the golden foil, and it's got the words, and it's got the nice logo, and the cool script. Ah, Cadbury cream egg with its promises of goodness. Nom, 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 nom! And underneath that, we have a layer of chocolate. Chocolate, dark, muddy, colored clay, colored chocolate, which is fantastic. And then underneath that, the center, we have the, what is that? Kind of sugar goo. I don't know. The yolk, right? Sugar, sugar, sugar. So, of course, the Cadbury cream egg is good all the way through. the three layers of self, you kind of get this, right? Even if you're not a psych major, even if you're new to Buddhism, even if you've never been in this building before, you kind of get that on the outside is the thing I want you to see. I want you to see. This is the shiny thing. Tell me I'm smart. Tell me I'm handsome. Tell me I'm good. Tell me I'm tall. Tell me I'm thin. Tell me I'm whatever the flavor of the week is. It depends on whether or not I'm at work, or I'm at Zen Center, or I'm in traffic. Here I want to be a good driver. Here I want to be enlightened and wise. And here I want to be like competent and efficient. Just whatever. Just tell me the good, right? So here's that's what I'm going to show you. Here's my smart. Here's my good. Nothing to worry about here. Right? Move along. These aren't the droids you're looking for. I'm not a communist. Everything's cool. Okay, yeah, that guy seems okay. Whew. Now, I know everybody knows that feeling, right? Because you already know underneath that is a huge, heavy layer of, in our metaphor, clay and plaster. And this is what I don't want you to see. Here's my pain. Here's my fear. Here's my shame. Here's my brokenness. Here's the fact I pick my teeth or snore or wake up with bad breath. In other words, Jung would have called it the shadow. Everything about you I don't want. I don't want made public. Please don't see this. I'm ashamed of this. I don't want you to know this. So I'm going to show you the opposite so you don't see this, right? All right. In Western psychology, we would call this persona and shadow. Persona is the storefront. Oh! Shadow is never mind. Please look elsewhere, right? Persona and shadow. We all know this. We all know this. And the problem is we act out of this for so long that we do exactly what they did in the story. We forget that it doesn't stop there. There's something else underneath that. Right? So last... when I gave this talk an hour and a half ago or whenever it was, somebody raised their hand and said, the doctrine of original sin, she was raised with the doctrine of original sin, right? She said, that actually makes sense to me now in a sense because I realize we've all forgotten that there's another layer. If you had to invent a belief system based on everything you knew about yourself, you'd have to start with all of your brokenness because that's as deep as you think it goes. Right? Don't we sort of think, like, on some level we're aware, what I'm showing you is kind of bullshit, but I really want it to be true, but, you know, like, there's some dance between what I consider to be deeply true about myself, but the truth is, for most of us, I have the idea that if you dig into me deeply enough, you're going to find the bad stuff. Full stop, end of story. They don't know that if you keep going, there's something else, and that is original. So now I start going, oh, now this is Zen. I really get why Zen shows up the way it does, right? It has a persona. It has a sense. We have forms. We have rituals. We have chants. We have weird outfits. And there's a whole bunch of stuff that we do out here that's called Zen, and that is awesome. But the whole practice of Zen, the whole point of Zazen, the point of the liturgy, the point of the center, the point of the weird statues, the point of all of it is so that you get a chance to dig in, which is why meditation is hard and not easy, right? To go in to see, oh yes. And if you're really lucky, and if you have a kind teacher, and if you are brave and diligent, you will go so far that you will discover the other thing and go, oh, this wasn't actually me. There was something else that was much more deeply true about who I am. Something that was abiding. Wow. So, even the words that he uses, intentionally or unintentionally, in Kornfield, when he's telling the Golden Buddha story, are brilliant. He talks about how when the statue is known as just the statue, it's just the clay Buddha. Yeah, pretty nice, I guess. I don't know. He said, not the most handsome or refined work, right? If you were an art critic and you were super into Thai Buddhist art, you'd be like, yeah, I don't know, like C+, I guess. You know, but it's big, that's cool. It's 500 years old, okay, so props to you. B- maybe. You know, you're not knocking me out. This is how we tend to regard our defenses, right? That ocean of pain that you're hiding, the shame, the fact that you wake up with bad breath, the thing that you're not good at math, the thing that you're secretly ashamed of, the thing that informs everything that you do all day long, all of the time. You'd say, yeah, not too skillful, not too great. And then here's the cool thing about this metaphor. When we realize why it was made, it becomes brilliant. It becomes absolutely brilliant. Right? Historians are now, because I know a little bit more about the story, I know people who have gone there and seen it. They're just like, tears just burst out of your eyes. It's breathtakingly beautiful. Google it when you get home. Google Golden Buddha Thailand. Yeah. They realize this thing is so big and so heavy. I mean, it's made of solid gold. Like, solid gold. If there's an invading army coming in and you've got, like, a day, a week, I don't know how much warning they had back then. Probably not much, you know. Oh, my God, what are we going to do? We got to get out of here. Like, well, there's, it's literally impossible to move an object this large and this heavy. Like, we are full stop. They're going to get this thing. They're going to melt it down. They're going to turn it into God knows what. We're going to lose our treasure. And some brilliant nun or some brilliant monk had this unbelievably brilliant upload of, oh, I know what we can do. Cover it with mud. Why? Because they're never, they'll cover it with mud. They'll think it's a boring, 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 bad, uninteresting, quasi-skillful, whatever, right? But it becomes something you're not even interested in. Because in the story, people are coming and going and coming and going for 500 years. It never occurred to anybody there was anything there. It's hidden in plain sight. So when Thomas Merton's heart opens, he goes, oh my God, it's hidden in plain sight. Look, it's everywhere, every single person. Wow. Right? He has one of those wonderful moments where he sees right past the persona, couldn't care less about your gold foil Cadbury cream egg, right through the clay, right through the plaster, and all he sees is, right, the beauty, the eternal at the center is right there. I think all of us have had tastes of that kind of experience before, Buddhist or not Buddhist. There's a lot of different ways we get to those places. Meditation is one of them, but I think there are other times when, for whatever reason, the veil is lifted, and you kind of look around and go, oh my God, it's all just filled with light, and it always has been. Right? And the quality of those experiences isn't, I'm having a really weird, trippy experience right now. The quality of that experience is actually, this is actually the truth. This is how it always is. But I don't personally have the capacity to hold this. I can handle this for about 30 seconds, but I just can't. I'm too small of a vessel right now. And so, you know, the veil comes back. But when we have those little glimpses, we have those moments of seeing the Golden Buddha, they're unmistakably glimpses of reality. So much so that you don't doubt them later. Isn't that weird? You can be like alive for like 50 years, have 30 seconds of seeing the world differently, and be quite clear, oh, I saw the truth for 30 seconds. It wasn't, you had a really weird day, I ate a bunch of weird drugs. No, 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 it's not that at all. It's quite the opposite. You realize, oh, I'm just asleep all the time. That's all. Right? So before I go too far down this road, what I don't want to suggest is that that type of experience is what we are here to try to cultivate. And I also don't want to try to suggest that we are either awake or asleep. That's just a little too binary for me. It's just too binary. Sure, ultimately speaking, yeah, you're awake or asleep. You see it or you don't. But the truth is we're all on a spectrum. We're always on a spectrum, right? We're sliding back and forth. Sometimes your heart is more open. Sometimes it's kind of closed. Some 3/4, 5/8, 11/16. I used to build furniture, so it's all about the fractions, right? But one of the important things that this story does for me is it corrects a fundamental misunderstanding that I had coming to this building and that I had coming to this tradition 30 years ago or whatever it was. I kind of had it in my head that the journey was outward, that I, as a separate whatever I am, entity, two-legged, proud Homo sapien, splitter of the atom, I don't know, whatever. I'm a person, and my goal is to get to a thing called enlightenment. And so I hear phrases like, reach for the light. And I naturally think, oh, that's obviously something outside of me. It is an experience I do not yet have. It is an insight I do not yet have. It is a pilgrimage that I go on. All of these things, you feel the motion I'm describing, they're out. This is the experience I don't have. I want to move toward it. And what you're seeing me do with my body rocking back and forth, all this is movement away from me. Away from me. So what is it I'm actually moving away from? What is it I'm trying to actually get away from? If I would have been more self-aware, I would have seen. I'm trying to get away from all that plaster and all of that clay. I believe the first noble truth by then. Yeah, life is characterized by suffering. This is a rough ride. Once you're born, you get it. Okay. Okay, we all got it. Wow. Okay. And so then I naturally do what we all do with suffering, which is, well, how do I get away from that? Right? Oh, there's a crying baby in my chest. How do I get out of my chest? How do I go so far away from it that I don't hear the crying anymore? I hope you don't hear criticism in my voice. I was very critical of myself. When I saw this, I was extremely critical of myself for quite a while. And I now understand, oh, no. No, no, you have to do that before you can do the other. You know, you guys get that, right? We learn by contrast. You recognize things by contrast. So you try the one thing and it doesn't work, and then you go, oh, I get it. This is the door that's locked. That isn't the thing that works. And so then you know what an open door feels like. So that's okay. That wasn't me being stupid. It was me being human. You know? I was blessed and I was fortunate to have teachers who repeatedly and patiently reminded me of Zen 101, page 1, chapter 1, verse 1. It's inside. We go inside. We turn the light inward. We turn the light inward. Come on, you guys. This is Dogen. This is basic. You go in. All right, in. And then that's really good. And I sit for about a week and things are more peaceful. And I'm more patient on the bus. And I'm a better coworker. And my breath is mintier in the morning. And everything's great for about a week or about 2 weeks or whatever. And then all of a sudden, the other stuff starts to show itself, right? I mean, my persona, my little gold foil label or layer is only so thick. There's not that, I mean, even when the waves quiet down and the lake starts to settle, then you start seeing all the stuff at the bottom, which is what I came up against, right? That's what everybody comes up against. It's why we quit. At the beginning of Zazen, I felt fine. I set a timer for 40 minutes. I sat cross-legged. I faced the wall. 40 minutes later, the timer went off, and I was crying. Zazen made me sad. It's like, no, it didn't. No, it didn't. It has no abiding qualities. You didn't ask anything of it. You just sat and watched your mind, and sadness showed up. And the truth is, that's a moment of fantastic celebration and brilliant meditation, because now you know something that you didn't know before. And it was inside of you all along. Hello? Oh, there's suffering, and you get a chance to befriend that. And you get a chance to hold that. And you get a chance to care for that, because that's what light does. It shines on what is dark. That's what compassion does. It moves to the thing that is hurting. That's what wisdom does. It tells the truth to something that isn't true. Right? You kind of get the whole motion is actually entirely intuitive. This is the nature of the spiritual path. That's what it does. That's like actually what it's actually designed to do. So the cool thing is about the Golden Buddha metaphor is at some point we realize on the cushion that benevolent, kind, loving, hopefully compassionate and wise witness that we're working with, that we're cultivating, that we're beginning slowly but surely to identify with. Does that make sense? Okay. It's coming from inside. Like that's me already. That was inside. That was inside. That's actually me. So I'm actually, it's the Golden Buddha itself, that part of our consciousness that looks at the plaster and the clay and looks at the persona. So when I'm seeing my wounding and I'm seeing all of my social defenses through the lens of judgment, I'm not seeing it from that place, am I? Do you kind of get it? Because what does Buddha consciousness do? What does it judge? What does it amputate? What does it say is unacceptable? Nothing. How could it? Like literally, how could it? If I am the light, if I am the awakeness, if I am Buddha nature, if I am Mu, if I am the unconditioned, if I am the divine, if I am the spark, if I am the... All the traditions have different words on this, right? All beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. Like, you are that. That's Zen 101. If I am that, then what am I doing trying to reach for that? I am that. Light illuminates darkness. Compassion goes toward pain. Wisdom goes towards delusion. That's what it does. And it never does it with judgment. It never goes in there guns blazing because there's never an enemy. It sees all that clay and plaster and goes, oh, how brilliant you were. How brilliant. You kept it safe. You did something unbelievable. You kept it safe. And the cool thing is you didn't even know you were doing it. Right? All the defenses that you adopted to keep that sweet, tender little child's heart alive, you didn't even know you were doing it. You didn't even know. But you figured out some wild spiritual alchemy, some way of like, I know my heart isn't safe here and I gotta hide it. I gotta do something. And so you figured out. You dissociated, right? Or you got angry and you fought. Or you ran. Or you froze. Or you did all of the above. Right? But you figured out some way of keeping that tender little thing alive. Your defenses. They're not an enemy. They're this unbelievably brilliant piece of kung fu that you did. Thank you for doing that. Seriously, thank you for doing that. If that nun, if that monk had not figured out, we need to cover this thing in clay. We need to tell a lie right now. We need to pretend like this isn't here, or else it will die. And then we forget that we told the lie. And we forget that the truth was there the whole time. Isn't that wild? Do you see the brilliance there? Good, you guys are awesome. Look at you sitting here. Wow, light in your eyes. Easter morning. At a Zen Center. What a world, right? So, all right. Before I go too far off my track here, Pema Chodron. You guys know Pema, I assume? There is a way we can be with our suffering that can change the world. There's a way we can be with our suffering that can change the world. To me, this is the introduction of the Bodhisattva ideal. This is the way the Golden Buddha sees the clay. It's certainly the way the Golden Buddha sees that foil and that paint on the outside. There is a way we acknowledge and relate to our suffering that can change the world. I'm saying world, she's saying world here, because this is the point at which, in Mahayana Buddhism, certainly including Zen, the Golden Buddha Project stops being the model of the one self, and it starts being the model of our collective self. Do you get it? Every human you've ever met has the persona. Every human you've ever met has the shadow, the pain, the shame, the fear. Every human you've ever met has the gold at the center. That's just how it is. Some of ours are thicker, some of ours are thinner, but we all do it. This is the human project. You stack every single human life that has ever existed on this planet all together in one big mound, and that mound is the shape of the Buddha. And on the outside, it's all the stuff we want you to believe about us. We're smart. We're awesome. We walked on the moon. We split the atom. Woohoo! We found the truth. We know how the universe was created. Right? Do you feel it? Do you feel sort of the 12-year-old part of you go, I'm big! I'm big! I'm important! I'm important! Love me! Do you feel it? This is where we are as a species right now, right? We're right at the tipping point. Can you feel it? You can feel that we're like, that's sort of not working so much anymore, sort of like not as much as it used to. And you can sort of feel that underneath it is, oh my God, look what we've done. Look what we've done. Look what we've done out of our misunderstanding. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And it's so easy to stay there. It would be so easy to spiral into despair and stop because we think that's who we are. We're nothing but bad. All we do is oppress each other, kill each other, murder each other, imprison each other. That's as good as we are. That's it. End of story. And there's a deeper, more truthful part of every single one of us that knows otherwise. I know that you know otherwise. You've heard Mozart. You've watched dancing. You've seen Baby Ducks. You've watched the same movie 5 times in a row because it always makes you cry. There is some part of you that is fundamental awakeness and knows there is something bigger and more true about all of this. And if I want to put words and a belief system around that, yippee! And if I don't, who cares? Because it's unvanquishable. It's consciousness itself. Underneath all of that is that part of you that goes, do you remember? It's me. So Zen, the whole path, the whole human project in my eyes, is just a way of coming back and remembering. We're not inventing some new thing. This is what you were born with. Everybody in this room's held a newborn. Tell me there's something wrong in those eyes. Tell me the human race is done for when you look in those eyes. You can't. They're fundamentally hopeful. That optimism is immortal because life keeps happening. Every spring it keeps happening. Every spring it keeps happening. Death turns into life. We can't stop it. People keep having kids. We keep falling in love with them. If we had given up, we wouldn't be doing it. We would have been done. Even the most jaded among us, some part of us goes, damn, there's just always a weed growing up between those two cracks on the sidewalk. It won't stop. I am that. You are that. It keeps happening. It's fundamentally good. So then when we see our pain and we see our defenses, we see each other's pain and each other's defenses, we can fall in love and go, thank you for doing that and keeping yourself safe. And you know something? It's not you. It's not you. That clay is fine. Thank you for figuring that out, but it's time to let it go. Because that clay ain't you, man. And you can love it all the way down, and then it'll disappear all by itself. This isn't an amputation. This is a loving into, right? And that's what meditation is. Something shows up, and you go, hey, buddy, I got you. I see you. I will meet you with compassion and wisdom because I am Buddha. That's what my teachers taught me. That's what I try to teach other people. And then progress goes out the window. Who cares? Enlightenment goes out the window. Who cares? This is the activity of enlightenment. I'm just participating in it. Whatever. Self is sort of there, but self is sort of not there. You kind of feel where it doesn't really much matter. It's your project. It's the project. How it felt today even stops being so important. Because the nature of the beholding is what's transformative. So I got to wrap up here with a couple quotes. The cave you fear to enter contains the treasure you seek. That's Joseph Campbell. Isn't that irritating? The cave you fear to enter contains the treasure you seek. It's like, oh, Murphy's Law, of course it does. The one that's really, really nice and comfortable never has anything in it. The one of like, oh, spiders, snakes, dark, oh, that'll be, oh, of course it will. Stupid universe. And the truth is, the cave we all fear to enter in this room is ourself. That's the only cave there is. We are actually very ambivalent about awakening. We want more awareness, and we do not want more awareness. That's true. I think acknowledging the tension that exists in us, I really want to wake up and see it. And then you wake up and see it and go, whoops, I wish I didn't know that. Remember the Matrix? You take the pill and you wake up, and the very first thing you wish is that you'd taken the other pill? Yeah, welcome to awareness. The cave you fear to enter. From the Tibetan Book of the Dead, O nobly born, O you of glorious origins, please remember your radiant true nature, the essence of mind. Trust it. Return to it. It is home. The Golden Buddha. Buddha nature. You are nobly born of glorious origins, remembering your true radiant nature. So although our job in this tradition is to discover the gold core, we also get to rest in the awareness that all of it is Buddha. The gold at the center is Buddha, and the clay on the outside is Buddha, and the persona and the gold leaf on the outside is Buddha. It's all in Buddha shape. It's all Buddha. There's no enemy there. There is no progress to be had. There is nothing to not love. The process of loving it itself is it. Does that make sense? When you're met with your clay and your suffering and your shame and your anger and your greed and your hate, and it exists in your heart, I promise it does. It exists in all of ours. And you go, oh, yes, there it is. Oh, God, right, yes. I'm holding you. I am with you. I will feel you. I will tell you the truth. That's not who you really are, but I'm willing to be with you. That is the activity of the Buddha. So all of it's Buddha. It can't not be. Progress goes out the door. Enlightenment goes out the door. Boom. Practice and enlightenment are one thing. Wow. So, there is only one golden Buddha, my friends, and now you know where to find it, which you always did. That's as much as I have to say today. Thank you for your attention. And we have a few minutes if anybody's got stories or questions. Has anybody by any chance seen it? Has anybody actually been to Thailand? And my inhalation almost knocked me off my seat. I actually don't know where it's currently housed. That sounds right, though. Like 13 feet, is that right? I only know one of my teachers has seen it, and she said she had to wait in line for I don't know how long, and she only got to see it for about 2 minutes because then they had to close the place down.
I mean, the toe is probably one toe. Is
wow! Oh my God, you guys! So if you have questions about the Golden Buddha, please go talk to our one eyewitness. Does anybody else know that story? Does anybody know the Cornfield book in the story? Oh, good. Well, read it. I think it's The Wise Heart, but if you Google this stuff, you'll find it. Anything else? Please.
I have a question. So, sure. In the analogy, the danger to the Golden Buddha is that it's going to get like melted down.
Mm-hmm.
What is the danger to our inner self, our Buddha self?
Ultimately, there is none. But that's a good question. Ultimately, there is, I mean, because it's unsulliable. Unstainable. The way the metaphor works for me is it includes the idea of time, and that here we have the Golden Buddha, and then a threat comes, and then we cover it to keep it safe, and then we forget that it's there, and so we cover it with something we like. Does that make sense? And I think, well, I know, for all of us, we are born with this, oh, that wide open, wide awake, tenderness, the availability to everything, because that's the nature of our consciousness when we're very, very young. And slowly but surely, we are given experiences that cause that degree of permeability a huge threat. It actually becomes impossible to maintain that kind of openness. So at some point you learned there's self and there's other. And then at some point you learned there's good and there's bad. And then at some point you begin to internalize that and go good, bad, and you create a split, right? So the threat, I think, to the little tiny soul, the little tiny essence, the little tiny separate drop of the Buddha that we are, whatever metaphor we're using here, is that the world is not a safe place. It's like actually not. Does that make sense? In a relative sense, it's unsafe. And so figuring out ways to keep that tender, sweet little heart beating is why we create defenses, you know? And of course, again, to use the metaphor, we do that so much, so long, so thoroughly, so well, we identify now the self with the defense instead of the self with. Am I answering your question?
Yes. So okay. I mean, if I could repeat back to you.
It's sure.
Processing this. So we have this inherent capacity for oneness, for connection.
Yeah.
And when it is unreciprocated in the larger world, I guess we can't not reach out. So we plug out that little bit of it and plug out the other little bit of it, and that's like the clay going around it.
Yeah.
Because we don't know that just feeling the bittersweetness of non-reciprocation is okay. Yep. And so that's how we end up covering ourselves up. Yep. Is that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a lot more we could do to, you know, a three model or a three-part model of the self is by definition rather fast and loose.
But helpful.
Well, I love it. I've actually used this a lot. When I first read this probably 10-ish years ago, oh, I use it all the time. And the reason is because, again, this is just me being personal now, it helped me befriend the clay. Because after a little while on these cushions in this room, I started realizing, oh my God, I am filled with greed. I am filled with anger. I am filled with resentment. I am filled with fear. I am filled with shame. And then I immediately judged all of those things as being bad and as proof I shouldn't be here, because I'm here to be, oh, not ugh. And so the metaphor, and of course also my teacher said, oh, no, that's all fine. You needed all of that. It's not who you are. It's not who you are. I mean, you're not those things. But the way to get to the golden center is there's no way of doing an end run. Like, you can't skip that, sweetie. If you want to get to the golden Buddha, you have to go right in through all of that, and you have to actually go back and not only feel, but tell the truth to all of those little, you know, those moments when you had to shut down and lie, right, to keep yourself safe. Does that make sense? I know you did, because you do it all. We do it all the time. It's just the human condition. You know, what do you think of my? We're talking about keeping our essence, our truth safe, our love safe. And yes. Ego defense, yes. Yep, and I think you're right. We operate out of defense to try to keep our sense of self safe. Please keep seeing me as shiny. Please keep seeing me as good. Yes, you're exactly right. And of course, like you say, we're unaware that underneath everything is the... So the three layer, I mean, it is overly simplified, but I think it works because ego is very much the place we operate out of most of the time, and we're trying to protect it all the time. You know, keep the paint looking good, just like you say. Keep the gold leaf putting on there. You know, keep the plaster looking good. Yes. I'm attractive. Because we so fear someone knowing what's under it. Yeah.